Good morning. Welcome to another Morning Java brought to you by our friends at the Getco Cafe Market, where it's the best time of year. It's fall. They have the Pilgrim Sandwich back, which is like a Thanksgiving in a sub. Incredible. Check it out. You can get it without cranberry sauce if you're like me. And then two different kinds of pumpkin milkshakes. That's crazy. Both are good. Check them out. But Monday, some pretty big moves in the Penguins front office. The first move early around noon, the Penguins fired assistant GM Jason Karmanos and replaced him, both of his roles. So the new assistant GM in the interim, Sam Ventura, who is the director of hockey research. And then Karmanos was serving as the GM of Wilkes-Barre. And then he's going to be in the interim. That job is going to Eric Kiesley. Kind of curious timing, Dave. I mean, what did you think about that move?
It was quite surprising. I certainly did not see it coming. The people I've spoken to inside the organization really didn't seem to see it coming. Karmanos had just been made the general manager of Wilkes-Barre not long ago. Certainly suggests that the plan at that point had been to have him in the future or in the organization for at least a little while. When I asked Jim Rutherford why the move had been made, if he would like to explain it, and he said no, which is as much detail as he went into. He did confirm that it was nothing nefarious behind the firing, which with the times we live in, unfortunately, is a question you always have to ask. For his part, I Jason Karmanos, I was able to reach by text. He said that he wasn't inclined to discuss the situation, at least not right now. But just by the tone of his text, it really seemed like this was not something that he had seen coming. So it's obviously something we'll continue to look into to see exactly what was behind it. But I dare say it was a move that caught a lot of people off guard.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned the timing. I mean, they just named him GM of Wilkes-Barre 2 months ago, I think. It was right, I mean, after they promoted Vellucci. I mean, you also figure if you're going to make any changes to the GM, I don't know why it's coming now after they're pretty much done in free agency. I don't know what else can come from that. And, I mean, the big thing, I know a lot of fans are like, oh, you know, they're opening up a spot for Botterill, but it seems like that's not the case.
No, it's not. I mean, I fully expect Jason Botterill, unless some other team offers him a GM job, I expect him to rejoin the Penguins at some point, but this move was not made with the idea of bringing Botterill back. Rutherford confirmed that they will be hiring an assistant GM, which, you know, is only logical. But I don't think it will be Botterill. And frankly, if he comes back or when he comes back, I would expect it to be in a position something along the lines of associate GM, which is a notch above assistant and is the title that he had here before he went and joined the Senators. So, you know, to wrap it up, yeah, I do expect Botterill to be back, but no, this move was not made to clear a spot for him. Frankly, considering the size of the front office staff they've had in the past, you know, they wouldn't have had to open a spot for him. You know, there was a time when Karmanos and Botterill and Billy Guerin were all here, and possibly even Tom Fitzgerald. I'm not positive about all of the overlap there, but in any case, there were a lot more desks occupied in their front office a few years ago than there are now.
Yeah, and in the interim, I think it's pretty cool to see Sam Ventura step into that role. He's young. He's like, I think he's like 32, 33. He's from Carnegie Mellon. He's an analytics guy. He founded the website War on Ice, which is one of like the pioneering advanced analytics websites in hockey. I know he was doing stuff like the Carnegie Mellon hockey team, and then that's when the Penguins picked him up. But they added him in 2015 as a consultant, and then full-time in 2017. So he's been around for a while, and it's cool to see him get a bigger role. He was directly under – so, like, Hormanis was the one that brought him on. He was very analytics, you know, focused, and then that's what Ventura's role is. So I don't know if he's a candidate for the full-time job, but it would be interesting to see maybe if they could take on a more analytical approach if he is the guy.
Well, Rutherford is pretty strong on analytics as well, which is why he brought Karmanos in. And as you say, Karmanos brought in Ventura then. So, but, you know, as far as what the exact division of labor will be once the entire staff has been assembled, it is kind of tough to say. And it might hinge on exactly who it is that they hire for the assistant or assistants position. You know, they have had more than one subordinate to Rutherford in the past. And, you know, I don't think it's out of the question that they will again in the future. Any hirings, though, I wouldn't be surprised if they put off just because of the revenue that's being lost because of the pandemic. They're trying to hold down their expenses, which I think is probably the primary reason that Jason Botterill hasn't been brought back to this point.
Yeah, and then a couple hours later, they announced another hiring. Trevor Daley officially retired. He was playing for the Red Wings, and he's coming on, joining the hockey operations department. They said he's going to be an eye in the sky, work directly under Jim Rutherford, and kind of being watching NHL games, AHL games, and kind of he's an advisor. And I thought that's a good move. I know Rutherford, you talked to him, sounded like he's wanted to do this for a while.
Yeah, he said, you know, from the when he was around Trevor Daley, when Daley was here in 2016 and 2017, he was just very impressed with him. It seemed like primarily as just a human being. He also obviously recognized and appreciated his hockey acumen, but Daley's personality, the way he formed relationships with teammates and things like that, really seemed to make an impression on Rutherford. He said he had decided while Daley was still here that he was the kind of guy that Rutherford would like to get into management at some point. It's worth noting that when Daley spoke with reporters on Monday afternoon, that he didn't rule out possibly getting into coaching at some point. He did say that, you know, right now he's leaning toward the management side of things, but that the position he's being brought into will allow him, it sounds like, to dabble in coaching at least a little bit. And so he didn't rule out possibly veering in that direction at some point in the future.
Yeah, and I think it's good with, you know, him being a defenseman, and they actually have pretty good defensive prospects coming up now with Pio Joseph, Maniscalco, Camley. I think it'll be good for him to work with them because he is going to be working in the AHL. And you mentioned coaching. I mean, he could be an assistant coach for Wilkes-Barre a few games. They do that with player development coaches like Tom Kostopoulos will sometimes be an assistant coach. So, I mean, that's something Daley could step into too for a few games during the season, and be that eye and report back to Rutherford. So, yeah, seems like a good move for the organization.
Yeah, I don't think that, you know, that's going to be a major aspect of his job. I think primarily in the evaluation of American League talent, I think it'll be primarily guys on other teams, you know, kind of like the information that their pro scouting staff assembles on guys that they might eventually pursue in free agency or trades or things like that. But you could certainly see Daley serving as an eye in the sky for Wilkes-Barre on occasion, or working a few games behind the bench just to get a nice level view of their prospects kind of flesh out his perspective on those guys.
Yeah, he's a good guy to learn from. All right, so we don't know when next season's going to start. We don't know when training camp for next season is going to start. We don't know how long training camp is going to be. And it seems like there's a push for maybe different lengths of training camps for different teams. Several reports that so the seven teams that were not part of the return to play agreement, the NHL, there's some sentiment with at least the Ducks, maybe some others, that they would like to have a longer training camp, you know, citing, you know, they haven't played since March and the season might not start till February. I think it's a really interesting concept. Dave, what do you think?
Well, I mean, superficially, it sounds fair and reasonable. You know, the 24 teams that were included in the postseason did get a couple weeks of a training camp before the games began, and the seven clubs that were excluded did not. On the other hand, and I think a much stronger case, is that the teams or the rosters that those teams will have whenever hockey returns are not the same as the rosters they had in March. There have been trades, there have been players moved through free agency, there have been retirements, there have been drafts. I think that rather than leveling the playing field for the teams that didn't qualify for postseason play, you're putting the teams that did qualify at a competitive disadvantage. And if you think about it, the teams that don't qualify for the playoffs don't get to conduct camps while the playoffs are going on. That's one of the penalties for not getting into the playoffs. So, you know, it's unfortunate that they will have gone so long without, you know, having a team together. But, you know, if you don't want to run that risk, you know, don't miss the playoffs during a pandemic year.
Yeah, I think there's just so much shuffling and free agency and other moves. Like you said, the rosters are very different. I mean, like the Senators were not there, but I mean, their starting goalie played in August. So does he get that extra training camp? It really doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Plus, I mean, what guys that were injured and didn't participate in the return to play because they were injured? Does Dominic Simone get to report to camp with Calgary a little bit earlier because he didn't play since February either? There's so many different levels to it. It really doesn't make a whole lot of sense. We're on the same page. I mean, if those teams want a longer training camp, what's wrong? Every team could have a longer training camp. I don't see what the issue is there. I mean, the players, you figured, I mean, most of them want to get back on the ice too, because I mean, this is the longest a lot of them have been away from the game for a while as well.
Yeah, although the Players Association might have something to say about that. I'm pretty sure the maximum length of a training camp is spelled out in the CBA. I'm not positive of that. It's never really been an issue before this, but, you know, there is a designated starting date for training camps every year. I suspect that the Players Association would want some sort of concession in return for a longer training camp, because, you know, players don't get paid during camp. They, you know, they get, you know, I think some sort of stipend, you know.
Per diem.
Yeah. But, you know, their salaries don't get paid until the game starts. So, you know, they might run into a complication there. I suspect ultimately that the non-playoff teams are going to get their request and that something will be worked out to accommodate them. I just don't think it's a very good idea or particularly fair.
Yeah, well, and if those guys want to get back on the ice, I mean, the NHL announced, I want to say like a month ago now, that facilities could reopen for like those informal skates. It was, I believe, October 15th, as long as I want to say the minimum was five players for that team that wanted to use the facilities, that the teams could reopen them. So if enough Ducks want to get together and skate, you know, this early, this the soon leading up to camp, they can. Not every team, I want to say, takes advantage of those informal skate opportunities. I mean, you look back leading up to the return to play. I mean, all the Penguins were here and skating pretty early. They had a really, really full group. So it was kind of like they had a longer training camp. I mean, coaches aren't allowed to be a part of that, at least not like the, like Sullivan, like head coaches. They can have like skating coaches. But so they can at least get on the ice. But I know that wasn't the case with every other team. I mean, Montreal didn't, you know, start skating until later. So, I mean, if the players want to get on the ice, that they can.
Yes, and good thing for the Penguins, they got in that extra work while the Canadians weren't bothering to get together. It really showed in the series.
All right, so something that could look different next year is the draft lottery format. A lot of people talking about that after this year's format is a little different with the return to play. What has everyone worked up is that the Red Wings did not get the number one overall pick. They were by far the worst team. Not by tanking. They were that bad on merit, and they still did not get the number one pick. And a lot of people aren't happy about that. They don't think that's fair. I know this is something you and I actually disagree with. I don't think they should touch the draft lottery format. So, I mean, for people that don't know, the non-playoff teams are in the draft lottery. They only draw for the top three spots. And the worse the team is, the better odds they have. Obviously, you know, Red Wings, they had the best odds out of everyone, but it does not guarantee that number one overall pick. I like the format as it is, Dave. I know you don't. What do you think should happen with that?
No, I don't. I mean, I agree that you have to build in some sort of safeguard against a franchise tanking to guarantee itself the top pick. I mean, we certainly saw the Penguins do that in 1983-84 when they had 38 points and managed to beat out New Jersey for the bottom spot and got Mario Lemieux in return for that. But I do feel that, you know, while you want to keep a lottery of some sort, that you shouldn't be allowed to drop more than one place in the draft order. For example, this year, the Red Wings, by virtue of having the worst record in the league, should have been assured of no worse than the number two pick in the draft. That way, if there is one big prize, like a Lemieux or a Sidney Crosby, you can't guarantee yourself the rights to that player by, you know, putting the worst possible team on the ice every night. But, you know, if you are genuinely bad and, you know, teams do go through legitimate rebuilds, I think you should have an opportunity to get good players. And, you know, the Wings probably got a pretty good player at fourth overall, but not the caliber of you know, the guy they would have gotten first, you know, if they were picking first or second.
Yeah, I just think after a lot of years, it's just so tight after in those first couple of picks. I mean, it was Lafreniere went, you know, number one to the Rangers, and the Kings got Quentin Byfield, and the Senators got Tim Stützle. After Lafreniere, it really was up in the air. You know, like, it wasn't clear who the next couple of picks were going to be. I don't think the Red Wings missed out that badly on falling to fourth. You can still get a really good player at number four. I think their GM Steve Yzerman has to be aware of that. He was the number four overall pick. I don't think it should be any closer to a guarantee. I think right now you should only be able to drop one spot. Right now, you can only, if you're first, you can only drop to fourth. That's not that far. I don't know. And the teams that were up there that you know earned that spot, they were also bad. It's not like the Red Wings are the only bad team. I mean, the Senators also really earned a pick. Mm-hmm. you know, that high, and the Kings earned a pick that high. They're also like very bad on merit. I don't really have a problem with the format. I think maybe if you could adjust the odds a little better, because I think what the Red Wings maybe only had, I think it was a 24.5% odds. I think if there's a way to adjust the odds to at least have the worst team maybe a little better chance, but I think falling to four is not that big of a loss.
And I also don't think that, you know, finishing 15th, or I guess it would be finishing 16th in the, or 15th from, you know, from bottom, that you should have a chance to get the number one pick in the draft. I think the lottery should be limited to, I don't know, the top six or seven teams. And you can't adjust it year in, year out based on how bad the bad teams are. But if you're theoretically that close to getting a playoff spot, I guess that would be the number 17 club most years. You shouldn't have even a remote possibility of getting the best player in the draft.
Yeah, like, because right now, I mean, those teams at the bottom, it's like, you know, like 1%, 2% odds. It was interesting if you look at the lottery that just happened, because, you know, the funky year, they broke it up into two phases, and, you know, they had the normal drawing, and if a qualifying team, you know, ball would have won, then they did the second drawing. But that first drawing, the specific ball that was drawn was if it was based on just the standings and, you know, which team would have had that spot in a normal year, the ball that got drawn had 2.5% odds of being drawn, and it would have been the Jets. So to sum up, if this were a normal year and there wasn't the two phases in the qualifying round, the ball that drawn was the Jets ball. The Jets would have gotten Lafreniere. That would have been a little crazy. Would have definitely pissed a lot of people off. I don't know. I think it all worked out on the end. I mean, the Rangers were a genuinely bad team in a decent market. Lafreniere doesn't have to go somewhere like Ottawa. So I think it all worked out. There's a bunch of different suggestions everyone has for revamping the lottery. The one of the worst I've seen, which is still somehow popular, is like a tournament of the bad teams, and they play for that pick. And I know a lot of fans like that, which is, it is dumb. Like, it's just dumb. I mean, if you're, you know, a borderline forward, and someone like Lafreniere is going to come and take your job, you're not going to go all out in a extra tournament just to get him.
When teams tank, it's not because the players intentionally try to lose. Again, I'll refer back to the 83-84 Penguins, where, you know, their 38-point season was orchestrated by management. Mm-hmm. They traded away their best defenseman, Randy Carlyle, and got no immediate return. They got ultimately a pretty nice return. They ended up with a number 9 pick in the draft and a serviceable defenseman named Mo Mantha in return for Randy Carlyle. But, you know, none of that help arrived in the 83-84 season when they were trying to hold down their point total. It's not a question of players going out and intentionally performing badly so that, as you say, someone better can come in and take their job. But management and coaches can go a long way toward making sure that a team is a failure on the ice.
Yeah, I think I should plug the documentary on that season. I know you can find it on YouTube, or if you just Google it, it's called Playing to Lose. About that season, and they have, you know, the coach, and then like Eddie Johnson, and Eddie Johnson still doesn't admit that they tanked. I mean, he not explicitly. I know he said the line he uses in that documentary a lot is that, you know, you have to do what's best for your franchise. He won't.
No,
say.
And Lou Angotti,
he admits
the coach,
it. Yeah,
he was adamant right up until the day he left the job that they had, you know, done everything they possibly could to win every game. And perhaps they did with the personnel that he had to work with, but it wasn't a very imposing group.
Yeah, I think of it in the documentary, and Gotti is kind of more honest that they were tanking on purpose. But I mean, in that documentary, I mean, like Ari talks in it, and Ari says, like, you know, we were not trying to lose, but it was management calling up guys from the minors who really shouldn't have been there, and demoting guys who should be in the NHL, and like you said, trading Norris winner Randy Carlyle.
Yeah, there was my favorite personnel move that year. Might not have been trading Carlyle, but rather sending down a goalie named Roberto Romano after he had the temerity to win two games in a row. And they brought up a gentleman named Vincent Tremblay because Eddie Johnston said, we want to see what he could do, knowing full well that the things that Vincent Tremblay could do did not include stopping hockey pucks.